Now, triggered by the threat of Ukraine sliding out of their sphere of influence, they were willing to hack information and put it into the public domain. "I don't know what we can say about this," I said. "What have we said so far?" "State hasn't commented." We ended up noting that the Russians were the ones who had published the video and calling it a new low in Russian tradecraft. Our relationship with Russia had steadily deteriorated since the reemergence of Vladimir Putin as president. We had assumed, perhaps wrongly, that Putin had supported all of the progress made through the reset of the first term, the New START treaty, Iran sanctions, Russia joining the World Trade Organization. Medvedev had gone out of his way to signal a better relationship with the United States. When he visited in 2010, he gave a speech in Silicon Valley, wearing jeans and reading the text off an iPad, trying to strike a picture of a future-oriented, forward-looking Russia. When he came to Washington, we arranged for Obama and him to eat lunch together at Ray's Hellburger, a casual place where Medvedev oddly ate his burger without the top part of the bun, gripping the bare patty with his fingers. I think of Medvedev now as a tragic figure, the guy who seemed to know better, who wanted Russia to step more firmly into the Western world. If life took a different turn, he'd be the kind of Russian who'd end up living in London and going back to Moscow on occasion to look after business interests. Instead, he was put in his place by Putin, a man who runs Russia as a personal fiefdom, a source of his own wealth and prestige. In retrospect, Putin must have been watching with growing concern as protests driven by corruption toppled long-standing dictators and oil prices began to drop. His own election in 2012 was marked by large street demonstrations and a healthy opposition. Once he was restored to power, the momentum in the U.S.-Russia relationship ground to a halt. The first time Obama met with Putin after he became president again, Putin showed up 45 minutes late. Putin rebuffed further discussions on arms control and missile defense. Russia continued its blank check of support for Assad. In August of 2013, Russia granted Edward Snowden asylum in Moscow. As a former spy, Putin surely understood the gravity of someone making off with the blueprints for how a nation conducts surveillance. In response, Obama canceled a planned state visit to Moscow. He didn't want to navigate the sideshow of Snowden being in the same city, but he also saw no point in attending a summit where nothing was going to be accomplished. I also noticed an unusual coziness among the Russians, Snowden, and WikiLeaks, the way in which WikiLeaks connected with Snowden, who was clearly being monitored by the Russians. The way in which the disclosures coincided largely with Russian interests, including the leaks from Snowden's stolen cash that seemed focused on sabotaging America's relationships abroad, particularly our alliance with Germany. Whoever was behind the disclosures was intent on driving a wedge between the United States and Europe, which also happened to be a key goal of Putin's, who deeply resented the expansion of NATO and the European Union into former Soviet states like the Baltic countries. While tensions had been building, Ukraine was a tipping point. To Putin, it was an existential threat to his rule and a part of Russia. It was the kind of crisis that creeps up on you in the rearview mirror when you work in the White House, a distant activity that comes further into focus until suddenly it is right on top of you. This happened in February, when more protesters started getting killed in the streets. Obama was wary. He didn't see the protests as a chance to transform Ukraine because he was skeptical that such a transformation could take place. He had inherited the Bush administration's policy that offered the prospect of NATO membership to Georgia and Ukraine. Russia had already invaded Georgia in 2008. The last time there was a protest-driven revolution in Ukraine, the so-called Orange Revolution of 2004, the leader ended up poisoned by the kinds of toxins that Russia uses against enemies abroad. Obama's outlook was closer to the European Union's. Change should be gradual. Ukraine should be able to draw incrementally closer to Europe. Over time, standards of living would improve, and a less corrupt politics could evolve. "If I'm living in Kiev," Obama told us during one meeting, "I can see how much better people have it in Warsaw. That's what's going to pull them closer to the EU." In late February, Obama and Putin agreed upon a formula that included a schedule for expedited elections in Ukraine. European leaders formalized the deal, and it seemed that the issue might be resolved. But Yanukovych fled the country, and protesters took control of Kiev. The scenes were reminiscent of the early days of the Arab Spring, a corrupt leader abandoning ship, jubilant young people cheering in the streets, images of exotic birds and a classic car collection inside Yanukovych's estate, confirming the worst allegations that he was on the take. But this was not the place or time for a revolution to succeed. The familiar rhythm of crisis, weekend meetings in the Situation Room chaired by Tony Blinken, email chains with updates, hastily scheduled press briefings. Russia was moving special forces into Crimea. These men didn't wear traditional uniforms, but they occupied buildings, controlled airports, and raised a Russian flag over the Crimean parliament. Just as Crimea evoked a 19th-century war, the names in play, Tartars, Cossacks, spoke to a rough part of the world where history was never far away. The Russians no longer bothered to calibrate their denials about what they were doing. They just lied about it. For the next few weeks, something approaching a routine developed. Obama would have a long conversation with Putin, trying to find some common interest we could work toward. These calls would last more than an hour, and Putin would always steer the conversation back to what he saw as the original sin. In his view, the protests that overthrew Yanukovych were initiated by the United States because some of its leaders received grants from U.S. democracy promotion programs. The people who took power, he told Obama on March 6th, made a coup d'etat. Obama argued back at length, stressing that we had no interest in controlling Ukraine, and that we respected Russia's historic bonds with that country. "Our consistent interest," Obama insisted, "has been in upholding basic international principles that sovereign states should be able to make their own decisions about their policies internally and externally." He'd get exasperated, but he never seemed surprised. He didn't think Putin was a grand strategist because he was acting on impulse, responding to Assad's opposition in Syria or Yanukovych fleeing Ukraine. He neither liked nor loathed Putin, nor did he subscribe to the view that Putin was all that tough. "If he was that sure of himself," Obama said, "he wouldn't have his picture taken riding around with his shirt off." On March 18th, Crimea was annexed. We began to ratchet up sanctions on Russia, targeting individuals and entities, oligarchs seen as close to Putin or involved in Ukraine. The value of the ruble plummeted. Massive aid packages were prepared for Ukraine. Obama was in the weeds, speaking regularly with Angela Merkel, designing a response that sought to thread a needle, hold together a Europe wary of conflict with Russia, pursue coordinated economic pressure through sanctions, and stabilize the Ukrainian government. "Aim first, then shoot," he told us. Our response went far beyond anything that the Bush administration had done to Russia after it invaded Georgia in 2008. But Republicans still castigated Obama as weak. Some even praised Putin as a strong leader, someone to be admired. Watching this, Obama told me that it represented something of a turning point for a Republican Party that had been rooted in opposition to Russia for decades. In Obama's view, the praise for Putin that you could see on Fox News went beyond partisanship, though that was part of it. Putin was a white man standing up for a politics rooted in patriarchy, tribe, and religion, the anti-globalist. "Some of these folks," he said of the more right-wing elements in the United States, "have more in common with Putin than with me." Publicly, my job was to make our response look as tough as I could. But nothing we could do was going to make Putin give back Crimea, nor would Obama go as far as the hawks in Washington who wanted us to send arms to Ukraine, even if we would never be willing to escalate as much as Putin. John Podesta, Bill Clinton's former chief of staff, had come on board as a senior advisor. Podesta was a brilliant guy, pencil-thin, with close-cropped hair, a strategist who could anticipate the turn that events would take in Washington. But he also brought something of the Clinton-era ethos. Obama should make his statements on Ukraine standing in front of Marine One, Podesta suggested, so he'd look tougher. McDonough described this kind of posturing as necessary to impress the Russian judges, his term for the Washington Commentariat. But even as I agreed that Marine One made for a great backdrop, it made me cringe a little. Standing in front of a helicopter was only a degree removed from posing with your shirt off. Obama's real strength was in his ability to hold Europe together while Biden took the lead in bucking up the Ukrainian government. In late March, we set out for emergency summits on Ukraine. Working hand in glove with Merkel, Obama kept Europe together behind sanctions and secured a multi-billion dollar IMF package that ended up saving the Ukrainian economy. Instead of sending weapons to Ukraine, he focused on deploying troops and military assets to the NATO members that bordered Russia. He started talking more and more about how he wanted to hand things off to the next president. I don't want to leave the next president in a position where there's not some kind of tripwires in the Baltics and those NATO frontline states, he told us. Putin needs to understand that even if we won't go to war in Ukraine, we will if it's NATO. After our trip, the crisis ground on as Russian-backed separatists started to occupy government buildings in the eastern Ukrainian cities of Donetsk and Luhansk. The Ukrainian military was trying to hold on to their territories with force. When Obama called Putin, he again pivoted back to Yanukovych's removal, telling Obama that protesters in the Maidan had also occupied government buildings. What was happening in eastern Ukraine, he said, was no different. There was something awkward about sitting in the Oval Office for these sessions. One leader, Putin, was lying about what he was doing and flouting international law. The other leader, Obama, was imposing sweeping sanctions on Russia. It never felt like a conversation. Putin would go on for 15 to 20 minutes at a time, then Obama would do the same. Obama ended with a warning. Despite the break in our relations, we still had time to resolve things in a way that could respect Russia's interests. On the other hand, Obama said he'd impose much stronger sanctions if Russia continued moving into eastern Ukraine. In that scenario, he said, relations between Russia and the West will be strained for many years to come. There is no need for that. Increasingly, Obama vented to us about the constant demands that he do more. Bomb Assad, arm Ukrainians, even though there was little evidence it would work. By his sixth year in office, he had used military force in Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, Somalia, and Libya, while escalating our use of armed drones against Al-Qaeda. He saw the necessity of drones, but he spent an extraordinary amount of time trying to impose restrictions on when they could be used, setting standards for whom we could target and how to avoid civilian casualties. I also saw the need for drone strikes and couldn't argue with their effectiveness in removing Al-Qaeda leaders. But I felt it was impossible to know whether every strike was justified. Obama once spoke to this mixture of support and ambivalence. If someone wrote a novel about us, he told me in the Oval Office, it'd be about two guys who got into this to end a misguided war in Iraq, right about the time that the U.S. government was perfecting the technology to use drones. What bothered both of us the most about the debates in Washington was the sense that there had been no correction after Iraq, no acknowledgement of the limits to what the United States could achieve militarily inside other countries. In one session that I went to with a group of foreign policy experts, we faced a litany of criticism for not doing more in the Middle East. After I patiently explained our approach, one of the participants, who'd been silent up to that point, interjected with an edge in his voice. You have to bomb something. What? I asked, taken aback. It doesn't matter. You have to use military force somewhere to show that you will bomb something. I saw the reasons why these arguments gained traction. Advocating intervention gets attention. And there's something innately American about believing that there must be a solution. Many of the people who work in American foreign policy today were shaped by the experience of the 1990s, when the United States was ascendant. The Berlin Wall had come down. Democracy was spreading across Eastern Europe, Latin America, and East Asia. Russia was on its back foot, and China had not yet risen. We really could shape events in much of the world. NATO could expand into the former Soviet Union without fear that Russia would invade one of those countries. We could bring together the whole world to kick Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. Obama occasionally pointed out that the post-Cold War moment was always going to be transitory. The rest of the world will accede to American leadership, but not dominance. I remember a snippet from a column around 9/11. America bestrides the world like a colossus. Did we? It was a story we told ourselves. Shock and awe. Regime change. Freedom on the march. $1 trillion later, we couldn't keep the electricity running in Baghdad. The Iraq War disturbed other countries, including U.S. allies, in its illogic and destruction, and accelerated a realignment of power and influence that was further advanced by the global financial crisis. By the time Obama took office, a global correction had already taken place. Russia was resisting American influence. China was throwing its weight around. Europeans were untangling a crisis in the Eurozone. Obama didn't want to disengage from the world. He wanted to engage more. By limiting our military involvement in the Middle East, we'd be in a better position to husband our own resources and assert ourselves in more places, on more issues, to rebuild our economy at home, to help shape the future of the Asia-Pacific and manage China's rise, to open up places like Cuba and expand American influence in Africa and Latin America, to mobilize the world to deal with truly existential threats such as climate change, which is almost never discussed in debates about American national security. Yet American politics pushes military interventionism, even as public opinion is wary. In the aftermath of 9/11, it became an imperative for politicians to demonstrate that they were tough on terrorism, with the measure of toughness being a willingness to use military force or flout the rule of law. Democrats were deeply scarred by elections in 2002 and 2004, when they were tarred as weak, untrustworthy, or even unpatriotic if they dared question the so-called global war on terror. With the public turning against the Iraq War and the election of Barack Obama, it seemed that this dynamic might change. It didn't. At least not in Washington. The very first debate answer I wrote for Obama in the 2007 primary season dealt with a hypothetical terrorist attack on the United States. I had been asked to prepare an answer on what steps a president should take in response, and he'd delivered it largely as I'd written it. The first thing we'd have to do is make sure that we've got an effective emergency response. The second thing is to make sure that we've got good intelligence. A, to find out that we don't have other threats, and B, to find out whether we have any intelligence on who might have carried it out so that we can potentially take some action to dismantle that network. John Edwards and Hillary Clinton pounced, making clear that the first thing they would do is go after the people responsible and take them out. Obama's response was treated as a gaffe. For many years, the phrase Vietnam Syndrome was used to describe the reluctance of Americans to get back into wars after the catastrophe of Vietnam. But it was often used as a term of derision, as if it was wrong to learn those lessons. In early 2014, with the recent example of the Iraq War still shaping the world in which we operated, Obama was already being roundly accused of overlearning the lessons of Iraq. So even as the Syria Red Line episode demonstrated that public opinion was skeptical of war, the political frame for national security debates remained the same. Doing more was tough. Anything else was weak. Obama's frustration with his critics boiled over during a lengthy trip to Asia in the spring of 2014. In the region, the trip was seen as another carefully designed U.S. effort to counter China. We'd go to Japan to bring them into the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, weaving together 12 Asia-Pacific economies into one framework of trade rules, environmental protections, and labor rights. We'd go to South Korea and discuss ways to increase pressure on North Korea. We'd go to Malaysia, something of a swing state in Southeast Asia, which we were bringing closer through TPP. And we'd end in the Philippines, a U.S. ally that was mired in territorial disputes with China over maritime boundaries in the South China Sea. Before leaving, we had a meeting in which a guy who focused on strategic planning at the NSC reminded us that the most important foreign policy work often involved incremental advances, hitting singles and doubles, as he put it. Obama leaned forward in agreement. "After I was reelected," he said, "I pulled together a group of presidential historians that I have in from time to time. People like Doris Kearns Goodwin, David McCullough, Douglas Brinkley. It's interesting. They made the point that the most important thing a president can do on foreign policy is avoid a costly error." He ticked through the list of presidents who had seen their tenures defined by such mistakes. Johnson in Vietnam, Carter with Desert One, Bush in Iraq. The lesson? "Don't do stupid shit," he told us, tapping on the table in front of him. On Air Force One, Obama sometimes liked to walk back to where the press sat, and he did this in the middle of our Asia trip. Usually this was planned in advance, but on occasion we'd just see him walking down the aisle of the plane. These sessions were off the record, but the reporters sent detailed notes back to their news bureaus, and the substance of the comments would ricochet around newsrooms, ultimately making their way into news analysis and Washington gossip. Obama complained about the recent negative coverage of his foreign policy, airing grievances that I'd heard him express privately about how the press ignored the steady work of American leadership and legitimized every demand that he do more to escalate conflicts. He went on a long tangent about how the failures of American foreign policy were ones of overreach, complaining about the lack of accountability for Iraq war supporters who were still the tribunes of conventional wisdom. Finally, he reached the end of his lecture. "What's the Obama doctrine?" he asked aloud. The silence was charged, as we'd always avoided that label. He answered his own question. "Don't do stupid shit." There were some chuckles. Then, to be sure that he got his point across, he asked the press to repeat after him. "Don't do stupid shit." At the press conference wrapping up his last stop in the Philippines, one reporter asked about the Obama doctrine, trying to elicit some less vulgar version. Obama didn't bite. Instead, he gave a measured description, saying that we needed to avoid errors, and that in foreign policy, you hit singles, you hit doubles. Every once in a while, we may be able to hit a home run. As we loaded the motorcade to head back to Air Force One for the flight home, I got a nervous email from Jake Sullivan. The reference to singles and doubles wasn't going to play well with the foreign policy crowd. I knew that was true, but I had grown as frustrated as Obama with the odd intersection of the triviality of our politics and the heavy-handed nature of our foreign policy critics. "Don't do stupid shit" would be panned, held up as a sign of negligence. But who is for doing stupid shit? Singles and doubles would be similarly derided. But what is wrong with hitting singles and doubles? And as Obama complained to me, "They keep forgetting that I said we're also going to hit some home runs." Chapter 22. Divine Intervention. We were on the long flight home from Manila when I started to get messages about the fact that another email I'd sent more than a year and a half ago was being made public by Congress. "Prep Call with Susan" was the headline of the email, which I'd quickly drafted for Susan Rice's Sunday show appearances. On a list of goals that I'd written was the line, underscore these protests are rooted in an internet video and not a broader failure of policy. I closed my laptop and felt a wave of dread. In the context of September 14, 2012, the email I'd written was not remarkable. That day, protests were erupting across the Arab world that were rooted in an anti-Muslim internet video. In the context of April 2014, however, the email was explosive. 19 months of investigations, hundreds of segments on Fox News, and thousands of talk radio rants had established the idea that something nefarious had taken place after the attacks in Benghazi. The talking points embedded in the document headed Prep Call with Susan had already been litigated in public by multiple congressional investigations. Those investigations had found no wrongdoing. But that only increased the appetite in some quarters for proof that the conspiracy theory was right, that we had invented this excuse of an internet video. Here, shouted 1,000 angry voices, was the smoking gun. The destruction of any objective truth over those previous 19 months was one of the strangest aspects of my experience. Toward the end of 2013, a reporter who was deeply sourced in Libya reached out to me. He was writing a long reconstruction of the events in Benghazi, including documenting the ebb and flow of the crowd, the way in which a large, angry mob ultimately turned into a smaller group of heavily armed men waging a military-style assault. People he'd spoken to, people who had been there in Benghazi that night, said that some people had gone to the American facility out of anger over the video. To protest, to loot, to kill, it depended upon whom you asked. "You're not in Washington," I said. If I went out and said that it was actually because of the video, they'd burn me in effigy. Benghazi followed me around like an unseen shadow. When I met strangers, I wondered if they went home to Google me, only to find a litany of conspiracy theories. I was embarrassed by the idea that my friends might have to defend me when talking to other people. I was doing more television, and the guy who arranged those interviews and followed me, camera to camera, advised me to smile more. "You have a natural frown," he told me. I had never thought of myself as unhappy before. In the days after we returned from Manila, the outrage over my email began to build. One weekday morning, I woke up around 7 to get my dry cleaning. Mets hat on, plastic-wrapped shirts draped over my shoulder, this was the most normal I could feel during the course of a day. I came up the stairs of my stoop, pulling my keys out of my pocket, when I was suddenly surrounded by a camera crew. They were from Fox News, shouting questions about the talking points as I hurried into my apartment building. Anne, who was pregnant with our first child, could tell something was wrong when I came through the door. "What's going on?" she asked. "There's a Fox News camera crew outside," I said. "What?" she said. Her face started to dissolve in some kind of fear. "Oh, no, Ben. Oh, no, no, no." There was panic in her voice, and I could see how much this was impacting her as well. We crept over to the window, pulling the blinds to the side, and looked out the window at a car that was parked illegally by the hydrant in front of our window. "What will the neighbors think?" she said. I ended up leaving through a set of basement stairs that spat me out into an alley. Any sense of cleverness I felt at shaking a tail was undercut by my shame at having to sneak out of my own apartment building through the back door where we deposit our trash. The White House correspondents' dinner was just a few days later. My brother was in town, and we went on our usual run. We ran along the Potomac, Northern Virginia on one side, the Kennedy Center and Lincoln Memorial on the other. He went on about how annoyed he was by the conspiracy theory that he and I fixed the news. He mentioned that he'd met with Lindsey Graham that weekend, a man who had recently called me a scumbag. When the run ended, we stopped a couple of blocks from my apartment. In past years, my brother had stayed with me. This year, he didn't. In past years, I'd gone to the CBS News party before the dinner. My parents had a photo of the two of us, with our wives, smiling at this event on their mantle in New York. I was still out of breath when he said, "It's probably a good idea if you don't come by the CBS party this year." "Sure," I said. "See you," he said, jogging in the other direction. I stood there for a moment, catching my breath, trying to reckon with the realization that my brother didn't want to be seen with me in public. Around the same time, John Boehner announced a new select committee to investigate Benghazi, and my email was cited as a leading justification. There was a video that went along with the announcement. It resembled a slick but cheap movie trailer, with each Republican member of the committee announced like a professional wrestler. Trey Gowdy, Mike Pompeo. Republicans sent out fundraising appeals citing the new committee. It was clear that the goal was to extend this charade into the presidential election in order to damage Hillary. It was the most politically motivated rollout imaginable, all founded on a theory that we had been the ones to politicize the deaths of four Americans. I felt I was living in an alternate reality that was in some way insane, unable to recognize hypocrisy or to separate facts from politics. The world around me seemed to have come unmoored. The truth had become irrelevant. That Friday afternoon, my deputy at the time, Caitlin Hayden, asked me to come to a meeting in the executive office building. It was actually a surprise party. I walked in to find a room full of people who'd worked alongside me for years. We drank scotch at a large oval table and talked ruefully about the controversy. At some point, everyone went around the room and told their own story about how much I meant to them. It was perhaps the nicest thing anyone has ever done for me. That sense of a family closing in around you, protecting you, no matter how bad it was outside. Each person spoke about something I'd done to boost their career, or a time when I'd done something funny or foolish. A younger guy said he decided to go into communications because of me. A former staffer sent a photo of her baby daughter wearing a shirt that read, "Team Ben." In a perfect snapshot of how incapable I was of handling what was happening to me, I had so much to drink that I don't remember most of these tributes. I somehow made it home and slept in my clothes on a bare mattress in our guest bedroom, soon to be used by our unborn child. The next morning, Anne tried to shake me out of my sense of self-pity. "This isn't a tragedy," she said. "My dad's scan was a tragedy." She was right, but I didn't know how to put that perspective into my daily life. A few days later, I got a call that Obama wanted to see me. I made the familiar walk down the hallway and up the stairs, a walk I'd made thousands of times, but this time I was filled with dread. I had a feeling that this was about Benghazi. I walked into the Oval, where he was standing behind his desk. "I hear you've been a little upset about everything that's going on," he said. "This whole thing." He gestured with his hand, not even saying the word Benghazi. "Yes," I said. "I'm sorry. I know it's a fraction of what you put up with on a daily basis. It's just an out-of-body experience, watching yourself be convicted publicly of a crime you didn't commit." "Did you do anything wrong?" he asked. It was, I realized, the first time anyone had ever bothered to ask me that question. "No," I said. "Then don't worry about it," he said. "All you have is your integrity, and you have as much integrity as anyone I know." The deeper I slipped into the abyss of Benghazi, the more focused I became on our discussions with the Cubans, determined to ensure that something positive came out of what felt more and more like an ordeal. But to get something done, we'd need some help. That spring, we found it. On a sunny morning in March, a group of White House staff trailed Obama as he made his way into the Vatican and stood in a large space with little furniture and huge paintings while he met alone with Pope Francis. For months, Ricardo and I had discussed involving the Vatican in our negotiations. It was an institution that had credibility with both the American and Cuban people, was neutral in foreign affairs, and supported a rapprochement. Our basic concept was that the Vatican could be a guarantor for any agreement, since it was hard for the governments of the United States and Cuba to trust each other. but we weren't sure how to enlist the Vatican's help, so we suggested to Obama that he discuss Cuba with the Pope. As the time ticked on, there was a slight stirring among the Vatican officials present. "The Holy Father never meets with people for this long," one of the priests said to me. After we were back at the U.S. ambassador's residence in Rome, I pulled Obama aside. "Did you talk about Cuba?" I asked. "Yes," he said, "as long as we talked about any other issue." He was very interested, coming from Latin America. I told him we'd established a channel. "What did he say?" I asked. "He was very supportive. He said he'd be helpful in any way he could. He seemed familiar with the fact that there is a dispute over prisoners." When I asked if they'd discussed any other details about our negotiations or what the Vatican could do, he looked surprised. "He's the Pope," Obama said. "He approaches things from a pretty high level." Before I left, he told me how much he liked the Pope, but also sympathized with him, given how much attention Francis had attracted since his accession. I know a thing or two about high expectations. In May, at our next meeting with the Cubans, we proposed a formal role for the Vatican. They reacted a little cautiously. The Church had a complicated history in a country that had embraced communism and restricted religious freedom. But when I mentioned that Obama and the Pope had discussed it, they warmed a bit. "Papa Francisco?" Alejandro asked. "Yes," I responded. "He and Obama spoke about how he could be personally involved in supporting what we're trying to accomplish. His involvement could also help with the politics in the United States." "Papa Francisco is a son of Latin America," Alejandro explained. "He was therefore viewed differently in Cuba from other popes, just as Obama was viewed differently from other presidents. With his involvement, they were open to it." The actual negotiations had reached an impasse. The Cubans still had not agreed to release the intelligence asset we had requested, and we had not agreed to release Gerardo Hernandez. It didn't help that we were meeting shortly after Obama had authorized a prisoner swap in which 5 Taliban inmates from Gitmo were exchanged for Bo Bergdahl, a U.S. soldier who had been held in brutal conditions by the Taliban in Pakistan for 5 years. On the day that Bergdahl was released, we'd been elated. He was the only remaining U.S. prisoner of war, and safely completing the exchange with the Taliban suggested that some future effort at peace talks might be possible. By coincidence, Bergdahl's parents were in Washington and were invited to come see Obama a few hours after the exchange was done. A few of us suggested that Obama make a statement in the Rose Garden with the parents. Pfeiffer and Podesta were skeptical, given that the exchange was with the Taliban. "The Republicans won't go after a prisoner of war, will they?" I said. Podesta grimaced. "I don't share your optimism." I had rarely been more wrong. I knew that Bergdahl had walked off his base, but I didn't know about the allegations that members of his unit had been killed looking for him. In the high of the moment, I'd failed to do my homework. Hostility toward Bergdahl from fellow service members boiled over, and there were days of heated criticism of the swap and of our decision to celebrate Bergdahl's release. The Cubans read the Bergdahl episode the wrong way. "We have noted Obama's determination to leave no man behind," Alejandro told me. I had to explain that the Bergdahl swap actually made things harder. To design the Vatican role, Dennis McDonough suggested we work through Cardinal Theodore McCarrick, who had once led the Archdiocese in Washington. McCarrick was 83 and retired from his official duties, but he was still something of a troubleshooter around the world for the Vatican. He met us early one morning for breakfast in the White House mess, a dining room on the ground floor of the West Wing, decorated like a 1950s country club, with large wooden chairs, wood paneling, and paintings of old wood-hulled Navy ships on the walls. As we sat picking at our eggs, I explained to McCarrick the outlines of what we'd been doing with the Cubans and how we wanted the Vatican's help. I could see him turning the problem over in his head as I spoke, a kindly man with youthful Irish eyes. "The Holy Father, he suggested with traces of a Bronx accent, would want to work through the cardinal in Havana. Jaime Lucas Ortega y Alamino. I nodded. If the Holy Father wanted to work through Cardinal Ortega, then that's what we were going to do. The way to initiate a formal role for the Vatican, McCarrick said, would be through a letter from the Holy Father to Raúl Castro and Barack Obama. The Vatican conducted diplomacy like this only in person, however, so the question was, how do we get Cardinal Ortega to Washington to deliver it? Dennis and I sat there without ideas while McCarrick thought this over, testing a couple of different ideas out loud before arriving at a solution. I can invite him to deliver a speech at Georgetown, he said. If you can assure him that Obama would be available for a meeting. A few weeks later, Cardinal Ortega arrived in Washington. We arranged for him to enter the White House through a side entrance so he wouldn't be seen by the press. Dennis, Ricardo, and I met with him and McCarrick on the back patio of the Chief of Staff's office. He clung tightly to an oversized envelope that contained a formal letter from the Holy Father. He was eager, almost giddy, smiling broadly and making small talk until Obama arrived and sat down with us. At that point, Ortega shifted to formality. Holding up the envelope, he told us, I have recently delivered the exact same letter to President Raúl Castro Ruz in Havana. He paused to let that fact sink in. Then, instead of handing us the letter, he took it out and, with a sense of ceremony, read it aloud in Spanish, pausing so that Ricardo could translate. It was a simple message, an offer to help resolve issues related to prisoners and to improve the relationship between the United States and Cuba. When Ortega was done, he handed the letter to Obama like a sacred relic. Obama gave me the letter, and I took it down to my office. I looked at the text, and there at the bottom, in the tiniest handwriting I had ever seen, as if the signature itself conveyed humility, it read, Francis. Perhaps not coincidentally, the Cubans had just sent us a message that they would be willing to hand over the intelligence asset we wanted if we released Gerardo. Suddenly, it felt as if the pieces were aligning. Ricardo and I asked for a meeting with Obama to see if we could get guidance on the final package we should pursue. Up to this point, he hadn't been in the weeds. When I'd brief him after my sessions with the Cubans, he'd sit there with a look of mild amusement. The report from our man in Havana, he'd say. Are you going to bring a Panama hat to the next session? His instructions were always the same. Go big. Now, with the deal imminent and the Vatican involved, Obama got serious. He began our meeting by saying that we should set aside politics. Politics is not something I worry about on this one, he said. The politics will catch up to what we're doing. His concern was making clear to the Cubans that if we released Gerardo, we'd have to get more than just Alan Gross and the intelligence asset in return. We suggested that the Cubans could release a large number of political prisoners and commit to expanding internet access on the island. Beyond that, I explained, the mere fact that the Cubans were agreeing to restore diplomatic relations was a big deal. We would get the new beginning, even though the embargo remained in place. The Bergdahl debacle hung heavy over the room. Dennis and others wanted us to press for the return of high-profile fugitives who were living in Cuba, including Joanne Chesimard. Chesimard is one of many bizarre subplots in the U.S.-Cuba relationship. A prominent Black Panther, she was riding in the back of a car on the New Jersey Turnpike in 1973 when the police pulled it over. In an ensuing shootout, a state trooper was killed. Chesimard escaped from prison and made her way to Cuba, where she was granted asylum. The FBI declared her a domestic terrorist, and a $1 million bounty was offered for her return. She also happened to be Tupac Shakur's godmother, and had deep pockets of support in the African-American community. We can try for Chesimard, I said, but I don't think the Cubans will give her back. A few days later, Ricardo and I flew up to Toronto to meet the Cubans at an airport hotel. When we walked into the lobby, we noticed a conspicuous couple sitting at the center of the bar area staring at us, a tattooed man and a woman dressed like an extra in a 1980s Madonna music video. As we checked in, they walked over to where we were standing and stopped a few feet away. The man took out an iPhone, held it out in front of him, and took pictures of us. Then they walked off toward the elevators without saying a word. "Russians," Ricardo said. "Why would they do that?" I asked. "They want us to know they're watching," he said. "They don't like this." In the meeting, we laid out the proposed package, noting that we still needed final approval from Obama on Gerardo Hernandez. I urged the Cubans to release a list of political prisoners that Ricardo had given them, to agree to increased access to the Internet, and to announce additional steps related to human rights and economic reform. I also went through a list of fugitives we wanted back that included Chesimard. I noted that we weren't trying to bury all our differences. "The day after we announce this," I said, "Raul Castro will still defend the revolution, and the United States will continue to support multi-party democracy. We'll have different views, but we'll address them through dialogue." It was a tough meeting. We argued around several issues, but the Cubans agreed to release almost all of the political prisoners, or, in the language they preferred, individuals who had been arrested for nonviolent political offenses. We hit a dead end on fugitives because it reintroduced the subject of Luis Posada Carias, the Cuban who had blown up a plane flying to Cuba. But we were now just testing what additional items could be added to a transformative agreement. When we took a break in the late afternoon, Ricardo and I walked across a parking lot to get takeout from a cheap Mexican restaurant, then bought a few bottles of wine at a nearby gas station. We laid out trays of food in our hotel room and set a table with plastic utensils. When the Cubans arrived, they were in a jovial mood, as if it was a social occasion. "So, when can you come to Cuba?" were Alejandro's first words to me. "Not yet," I answered. "First we have to go to Rome." We talked over a process whereby we would draft papers that memorialized our agreements and share them with the Vatican at a secret meeting in Rome. Neither side could go back once their commitment had been deposited with the Pope. The Cubans also insisted that we draft papers describing where each side continued to have differences, which was an interesting way to protect our political flanks. They wanted to note their opposition to the embargo, the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo, and other American policies. We could note our continued support for human rights and reforms in Cuba. The conversation gradually drifted to other things: baseball, Hemingway, Cuban music. Ricardo went into the other room, where we had left our phones for security reasons, and came back with his iPhone playing his favorite Cuban songs. The Cubans reacted excitedly, dancing in place at the table. Politics felt far away. Benghazi felt far away. In that moment, sitting there with five other human beings, eating Mexican food at a cheap airport hotel in Canada, listening to Cuban music playing on an iPhone, I felt a sense of grace. Chapter 23. Permanent War. Obama wanted to extricate the United States from the permanent war that had begun on 9/11. On the day he took office, there were roughly 180,000 troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. By late 2014, the number of troops in Afghanistan was down to 15,000. All U.S. troops were out of Iraq. These were meaningful achievements. They saved American lives as casualty numbers fell from nearly 100 Americans killed each month to nearly zero, and the cost of war shrank by tens of billions of dollars. Most controversially, he had kept the U.S. military out of Syria. By 2014, just about every negative force in the Middle East had converged in Syria, a murderous autocrat backed by Russia and Iran. Al-Qaeda-affiliated extremists, sectarian conflict, and a Saudi-Iranian proxy war. And ISIL, the rebranded version of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. As Iraq's Shia Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, isolated Iraq's Sunnis, and as the civil war in Syria left huge swaths of territory across Iraq's western border ungovernable, ISIL had turned into a mix of terrorist group, insurgency, and local government. In January, ISIL declared the Syrian city of Raqqa as its capital and started a steady advance eastward back into Iraq. In June, it took over Mosul, one of Iraq's largest cities, overrunning the Iraqi security forces who had been trained and armed by the United States. It then announced it was establishing a new caliphate and changed its name to the more ominously universal Islamic State. It was becoming apparent that we would have to intervene again in Iraq to stop ISIL's advance. The tipping point came in early August when ISIL took control of a dam near Mosul that, if breached, could have flooded huge swaths of Iraq. The Kurdish capital of Erbil, normally an island of calm, was under threat from ISIL. And most immediately, ISIL had driven tens of thousands of Yazidis onto Mount Sinjar. The Yazidis were a sect inside Iraq who believed in an ancient brand of monotheism with roots in Zoroastrianism and had preserved their tradition for well over 1,000 years. Yet ISIL saw them as infidels, and in early August they started to massacre Yazidi men and enslave the women and declared their intent to wipe the Yazidis from the face of the earth. For a couple of days, a sense of crisis enveloped the White House. Obama was angry that he didn't have good information. "We didn't get a warning that the Iraqis were going to melt away in Mosul," he complained to a group of us. "And now we can't even get a read on how many Peshmerga, the Kurdish security forces, are in Erbil. I'm not happy with the information I'm getting." It was quiet for a moment. "I'm aggravated," he added for emphasis. I was again in a chorus of advisors arguing for airstrikes. Obama agreed, though he told us he would impose limits on how aggressively we'd go after ISIL until Maliki was replaced by a less sectarian leader. So on August 7th, he announced that we would begin dropping food, water, and other supplies to the Yazidis trapped on Mount Sinjar, and targeted airstrikes would break the siege at the base of the mountain. The next day, I met in the Roosevelt Room with a group of Yazidis who had come to Washington to plead for military action to save their community from extermination. Many had recently immigrated to America. Some had been interpreters for the U.S. military during the Iraq War. They were not the polished diaspora representatives I was accustomed to meeting. Many wore T-shirts and jeans. One after another, they told me of dashed hopes after the U.S. invasion in 2003, of having to flee their communities after helping the U.S. military, and now of ISIL's campaign of terror. A patriarch with a white handlebar mustache sat across from me at the middle of the table, a huge painting of an idyllic American West behind him. When it was his turn to talk, he spoke in Arabic. He described women being taken from their homes and raped, family members being killed. Tears began to roll down his face. "No one will help us," he shouted. "Not Maliki, not Barzani. Only you, the most powerful nation in the world, can help us." Once everyone had spoken, they sat and waited for my response. I urged them to share information with our government about what the needs were on Mount Sinjar and where ISIL was so that we could target them effectively. I began to tear up. "The Yazidi people are a resilient people," I said, feeling slightly ridiculous but certain of what I was saying. "You have endured for thousands of years, and you will endure this." I walked down to my office and collapsed into my chair. The next day, I was drafted to go with Obama on his 2-week vacation to Martha's Vineyard. Anne was now a senior advisor at the State Department working on global women's issues. She was also 5 months pregnant and coming with me. These trips could go either way, a paid vacation with the president or a nightmare of nonstop work with a skeleton staff. On the Saturday that we boarded Air Force One for the vineyard, the United States began airstrikes on ISIL targets, and a young African-American named Michael Brown was killed by a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri. This was not going to be a vacation. Obama was staying at a large rental house on the other side of the island, an hour's drive from the staff. When we got to our hotel, Anne and I were shown to a small, dark room on the ground floor with twin beds. "I'm not staying here," she said. She didn't even sit down. I tried to block off time we could spend together, hoping to schedule something of a vacation within the confines of my job. But I had to spend hours sitting in a dark NSC office, wearing headphones, patched into meetings by secure video conference, so that I could update Obama. I had to draft statements on ISIL and Ferguson. I had to brief the press. When I didn't, reporters would wait in the lobby to intercept me coming and going. For the first few days, Anne veered between being patient and disappointed. But after seeing the direction things were going, she decided to go home. As in the previous summer, I didn't know what to do. I wanted her to stay, but I knew that I'd only be working. So I drove my pregnant wife to the airport so she could fly home to D.C., ending our last attempt at a vacation before becoming parents. I slogged through the days, driving to the nearby school where our press was camped out to answer questions about ISIL. Driving out to Obama's rental to staff phone calls, give him updates, or draft statements. He tried to cluster his work in the morning so that he could play golf or relax in the afternoon, and when I showed up, he always seemed a little annoyed, as if I were the stand-in for a world that was ruining his vacation. Nights, I drove to a cheap Chinese takeout place and returned to my room. There I'd sit on the couch, eating lo mein out of a plastic container, and watching cable news split-screen the unraveling of two of the loftier aspirations of the 2008 campaign. An end to the permanent war, and a bridging of the racial divide. We flew back to D.C. for a couple of days in the middle of the vacation. Shortly after we took off for the flight back to the vineyard for week two, Lisa Monaco called me. "Do you have a few minutes?" she asked. Lisa is a hyper-competent lawyer who had steadily worked herself up the ladder through a series of positions. Congressional staffer, prosecutor, chief of staff to Bob Mueller at the FBI, head of the National Security Division at the Justice Department, and now Obama's chief counterterrorism advisor. She sat across the hall from me in John Brennan's old office, which she had renamed the Lady Cave. She met repeatedly with the families of Americans held hostage abroad, including the four Americans held by ISIL in Syria. One of those Americans was a 40-year-old journalist named Jim Foley, who had been taken in northwestern Syria in late 2012. As I sat on the plane with a phone pressed to my ear, Lisa's voice kept cutting in and out. Finally, as the plane reached higher altitude, she came through clearly. There was emotion in her voice. "ISIL has posted a video of Jim Foley," she said. "A video?" "On YouTube. I'm watching it. Jim's kneeling in an orange jumpsuit. There's a guy reading a statement behind him." She started to give snippets from the statement. "This is a message to America. This is a message to President Obama." She described the man holding a small knife. It was quiet for a moment. Then I heard her voice crack. "Oh my God," she said. "Oh my God." Then she started to cry. I sat there staring at the beige wall in front of me. "Was he beheaded?" I asked. "Yes," she said. "I'll go tell POTUS." I walked into Obama's office at the front of the plane. He was sitting behind his desk, and Malia was on the couch reading something. I leaned over the desk, and he saw the look on my face, and his eyes opened wider with concern. He asked Malia to give us a minute. "They've released a video," I said. "Foley?" he asked. "Yes," I said. "He's been beheaded." I started to explain what I knew about the video. I hesitated a moment before saying, "They described it as a message to America and to you, in response to the bombing." Obama chose not to react to that part. "Foley, the journalist?" He seemed to want to ground this human being in a vocation, not in his violent end. "Yeah," I said. "The stringer who was taken in 2012. "I should call his family," Obama said, "and make some kind of statement." I looked at the clock. It was a short flight to the vineyard. We'd be landing soon, so I'd have to draft something. Are we trying to take the video down? Yes, I said. I think our media will cooperate, but they'll find some ways to get it around.